Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're listening in on this Monday. Dr. Mike Osterholm is with us for the hour. We're going to find out why he likens the spread of the coronavirus to a national forest fire and believes testing and contact tracing will not be enough to dampen the burn rate of the disease. On Stat News, infectious disease writer Helen Branswell calls it a raging dumpster fire that's going to be extremely difficult to extinguish. We'll talk about why. I'm also going to ask Dr. Osterholm to explain again why this novel coronavirus cannot be dismissed as a version of the flu or the sniffles, as President Trump recently claimed. We've gotten some calls recently that indicate there is still some confusion about that, and I want to bring some clarity to it. And we're taking your calls and your questions and putting good science up against speculation and rumor. What do you want to know about the latest science on how the virus spreads? What have you been hearing from your social media feeds or your friends that doesn't sound quite right? And what do you want to know about the basic science of looking for a vaccine? We're going to talk about that as well. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Latest science on transmission. Some of the things that you're hearing on social media or from your friends and family that doesn't sound right, and your questions about the search for a vaccine. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Dr. Michael Osterholm is a director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, and he joins us today from Minneapolis. And Dr. Osterholm, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Several times you have compared the way the virus is moving through our population as the way a fire consumes human wood. You could use a lot of different analogies. I wonder why you've chosen that one.
Well, just to remind everyone listening this morning that we really are in uncharted territories with a coronavirus pandemic. This is a novel virus that we've never seen a global outbreak or a pandemic with it before. Our previous experience has been with influenza pandemics when a new flu virus emerges. And in March and April, when it was being discussed, how might this move forward? What might it look like? Not a model, meaning the statistical analysis, which I find always troubling, but just a scenario. How might this happen? Well, if we look at influenza pandemics, they have traditionally performed in a very similar way. There have been 10 of them in the last 250-plus years. And when the virus first arrives, it does travel around the world, even in the days of just sailing vessels, and causes illness for several months to up to 5 or 6 months, and then recedes for reasons we don't know why. In 2009, when we had the H1N1 pandemic, we saw it occur in the United States here in mid-March. Cases continued to increase through April into early May, and then just all of a sudden, just the bottom fell out of it. It dropped out. And then we didn't see transmission of any notable quantity and through all the summer until late August. And then all of a sudden it took off again. And by far the biggest wave we had, the biggest peak, occurred in mid-September into early October. Yeah. Again, we were not trying to do distancing mitigation or any of that kind of thing back then. And so this was really kind of the natural history of the virus. So the question was, is this what the coronavirus is going to do? Is it going to be a wave and then a trough and then a wave? And in fact, by May, we could see that this wasn't going to happen. that, in fact, there was going to continue to be this ongoing pressure of the virus out there wherever it could. And it surely may be set off by time, meaning some places hit earlier than others. And we had come up with a document that actually laid out these scenarios. One was the flu, one was kind of a slow burn, and one was more of a rapid burn, more like the forest fire. Mm-hmm. So actually in May, we changed the scenarios and said, we're now locked into this one. This one is just going to keep burning. Where it's suppressed and put out, it surely could come back again tomorrow if the embers are there and starts transmission. As we talked about the last time I was on the show, we need to achieve what we call herd immunity before the virus transmission will slow down. This is where enough people in the population have either been infected by the virus and developed immunity that way or been vaccinated. And for a virus like this, it's going to take at least 50 to 70% of the population to be previously exposed or vaccinated to get that herd immunity. And so we said, this is just going to keep running. And it's going to come and go and come and go. And only with really active mitigation efforts will we ever slow it down. And our whole goal is to slow it down enough until we can get to a vaccine where we can achieve protection that way as opposed to the disease itself.
A couple things to follow up on what you've said. I don't want to miss what you mentioned about your being troubled by statistical analysis. You know, in the beginning of this, a lot of us were following, and there would be big headlines and breaking news on cable every time some analysis came out from Oxford or somewhere else. It sounds like you've been troubled about that from the beginning. Why?
Well, first of all, I've had a number of graduate hours of statistics, and I realize that a lot of this is black box kind of work where assumptions are made that can, in many instances, not even be close to valid what really happens. Some of the models are actually just based on previous experience, meaning that if I have 1,000 numbers in a row, I can predict the 1,001 number by looking at that sequence, which doesn't give you any sense about how this virus might change. For example, as it did from the March-April peak to the June trough, you might call it, and then took off again. Models missed all of that.
Oh, see.
And so I've never believed that models were all that helpful. I think they, as I've said before, all models are wrong, and some occasionally give you useful information. And so we've not relied on that in making any of our predictions at all. The surge in the kind of situation we see now was something we just said, this is based on that scenario I said about the wood. Just mm-hmm. think of a forest fire. If you suppress it substantially in a given area and then you don't clean it up, you don't finish it, it's coming right back. And that's the problem we're seeing right now around the country. So you just have to assume everybody who has not been infected with this virus is vulnerable to being infected. And if we don't take steps to stop that transmission, either by limiting how you have contact with people or having a vaccine, it's just going to keep marching right along until it finds us.
And one other question before we take some calls here. When you laid out those different scenarios and then you said it's now apparent that we're seeing the high burn rate, which is why you use the analogy of a forest fire, and you hear what Dr. Birx is saying about how this pandemic is changing the way, you know, where it's headed to, and I guess the way it's being transmitted. How do those two ideas intersect? I mean, could you have seen this coming, moving out of the cities, moving into more rural areas, and then putting some of these places that thought they were over the worst back at risk?
Well, you know, I dare say, I think if you were to go back and look at my previous interviews on your show, including one in April, I actually mentioned at the time that there would be no red and blue states by the time this was done. They'd all be COVID-colored states. There'd be no red and blue counties. They'd be COVID-colored counties. So we knew last April, March and April, that this was going to be doing exactly what it's doing right now. And so I'm somewhat concerned that the public health community seems now to, at least from Dr. Birx's comments, discovering what we all should have been aware of 4 months ago and doing something about to try to put that message out. You know, I've heard time and time again from Minnesotans who have been upset with my comments about, well, it's not a problem here. I'm from rural Iowa. I get that. And I kept saying, I don't want to make this sound like I'm wishing anything bad on you, but just take time. It's coming. It is coming, and it will be there. And right now, some of our hottest transmission areas in the state are in greater Minnesota. And so I think that's the challenge we've had is some people thought last March, when so much of the activity was initiated to try to slow down the spread, that it was going to be everywhere all at once. Mm-hmm. And it's not. But over time, it will be.
Dr. Mike Osterholm with us from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the U of M for the hour. Your calls and questions on transmission and vaccine development. I have some specific questions about that for Dr. Osterholm and some of the things that you're hearing on social media or from your friends and family that doesn't sound right. I'm trying to include this in a lot of our conversations about the coronavirus, because I know how fast rumor spreads, and this is a chance to put science up against rumor. So 651-227-6000 on that, 800-242-2828, Twitter, at CarrieMPR, to David in Minnetonka. David, thanks so much for waiting. Good to have you on the line.
Yeah, hold on just a sec. I've got to kill the radio.
Okay, well, David, we could take another call while
I'm there.
Oh, okay, go ahead. All right, go ahead.
Okay, Dr. Osterholm, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, so I've got two questions for you. I'm an industrial hygienist here in the Twin Cities, and I work with clients on helping them figure out how and if they want to reopen their buildings. My first question is about the nature of how one becomes infected. And what I mean by that, is it an acute exposure or a chronic exposure? Is it only a single large dose, or can this be small doses over the periods of days and weeks, whatever?
And what's the second question, David?
My second question is, how close are we to understanding an infectious dose? Because that is needed so that I can run the ventilation equations to figure out how much fresh air is needed to get down to a safe level.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Dr. Osterholm, or chronic?
Yeah, thank you. No, these were really very, very important questions. And let me just say that, because they really do translate much more even than just to the building, but to the public in general. Our group is at CIDREP is actually leading a group of 24 world experts right now in the area of infectious dose and the issue of protection and how to measure that. And so our work is going on right now, which includes aerobiologists, people who study infectious agents that move in the air, or agents in general, industrial hygienists like David. It includes people who are doing the animal research where monkeys are being challenged with the virus to understand what the infectious dose is. So this is an important point. I can't say that we have our conclusions yet. We're working as quickly as we can, but it doesn't look to be necessarily an acute dose. It could be, but it's likely an accumulation of inhaling the virus over a period of a day. So that, in fact, it kind of takes on more of a toxicologic kind of view. So I think that that's important. And that's important for the public, because as we're trying to understand how well the respiratory protection devices protect you, N95, surgical masks, cloth face coverings. And if I'm in the grocery store, am I in there for 5 minutes or 50 minutes? And what does that mean difference-wise in terms of exposure? So we are working on this issue, and I hope that we're going to have some substantial information on it within the upcoming weeks, so that the public can itself be more informed, and you and others who are making decisions about building ventilation systems can also address that issue head on.
Nancy,
so thank you for that really good question.
And Nancy tweets to follow on that, could Dr. Osterholm talk about the U of M's engineering study on HVAC? Best systems pulled 10%. The rest of the aerosols circulated and ended up on the walls. Is that right?
Yeah. One of the things that we're unfortunately having to deal with is a lot of misunderstanding about what we call aerobiology. When you and I talk, or for that matter, when we're just breathing, mm-hmm. we actually exhale out lots of particles. And imagine these particles from a standpoint of vision range from BBs to bowling balls. And they're consistent, meaning that they just keep gradually getting a little bigger, 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 bigger. Now, when you and I cough and sneeze, that's when the bowling balls typically come out. And they're the ones that fall short, just merely feet away, basically, from where I'm at. But the larger particles, some of them do go further than just a few feet. And clearly, the aerosols, these little tiny particles, float and float and float. And that's what we've really been concerned about. And this is where some of your listeners may have heard a couple of weeks ago, a group of international experts, 239 of them, sent a letter to the WHO saying, come on, get with it, guys. Aerosols are really important with this transmission, and it accounts for why we see some of these very large outbreaks. If you want to understand what an aerosol is, next time you see sunlight coming through the window in your house and you see all the dust floating in the air, that's an aerosol. That's floating. Or if you're walking down the street and all of a sudden you smell cigarette smoke and it turns out somebody is 40 feet in front of you, that's an aerosol. And what we're concerned about is me just right now in my office here talking. If you could film in here adequately, you would see I have turned this room into a flood of aerosols, meaning that if you could photograph it, you would actually capture them. So the caller is asking about what happens with recirculated air and how much do you have to recirculate? And one of the things we've been trying to explain to people is this is not an infectious disease tag, where if I walk by somebody, I get infected, which is David's point. Rather, it is how much time I spend in an area where these aerosols are floating. And occasionally, if I'm right face front to somebody, if these large droplets come at me. And that's where we're all working to try to find out just how long you have to be in those kinds of settings to actually take in enough of the virus. And so the study at the university was one of those ones that said, unless you're really moving a lot of air, you know, this is a problem. I hear this. I get so many questions from choir directors. Can we just, if we put all of our people together, we space them out, and my church has an air exchange once per hour or something like that, and we're sitting here talking about 12 times per hour, probably to exhaust off those viruses. So that's the kind of work we're doing right now to try to understand that.
Call here from Mark in Anoka. Hey, Mark. Good to have you on the phone.
Hello.
Thanks for waiting. Hi.
Yes. As a physician, I don't doubt what you're saying about the seriousness of this disease. But what I also worry about is the economic impact of close down. And where do you draw the line? How do you figure that out?
Yeah, and absolutely a spot-on question. We think about that all the time. So the challenge we have is if you look at what's happening right now, and Neil Kashkari, who is the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, and I think one of the most enlightened and really thoughtful economists in the country working on this these kinds of issues, has really looked at this, and his team has, is that what we're seeing right now with this kind of background level in the community, when it takes off, there is so much economic damage that occurs just from that. And just take a look at what's happened in the southern states. And, you know, I don't think most people realize it, but right now Minnesota is on track, if something doesn't change, is to become one of the southern states. Yesterday, we reported basically the most number of cases we reported this year, and we have throughout the past week. In May, when we were at a peak of 728 cases reported on May 24th, we dropped back down to 320 cases on June 19th, and everybody took a sigh of relief, we're all okay. Yesterday, we had 759 cases. And so when that starts to happen and things begin to shut down on its own, you can't open schools. You can't basically have many of the essential services. Your hospitals are overrun. At that point, that's a huge economic cost. So the challenge is, how do you find the right place on the break? And what we have found from countries around the world who have sure led the way in ways we haven't, or if you even look at the state of New York, which was a house on fire in March and April. And today they've had four straight weeks of flat cases. They had days last week with no deaths in the whole entire state. And what they did is they applied the brakes only after they got the numbers driven down to a manageable level in which they could do more testing and contact tracing. Doesn't mean they couldn't have a flare-up tomorrow. But they've demonstrated what you can do to kind of find an equilibrium with this virus. And so that's, I think, what we're all trying to figure out is how do we get that there? But I'll tell you right now, if you're in any one of these states, Minnesota included right now, testing and tracing is not going to have a material impact on our cases. It is like trying to plant your petunias in a Category 5 hurricane. It isn't going to happen. And so one of the challenges is, how do you get those numbers back down? How do you get them down and then keep them down once they're there? And that's the challenge we're up against. And Carrie, you asked a question earlier, and I think it just is a subtle reminder of what this disease has done. We all talk about 1918 and the challenge of what happened with the swine flu pandemic back then. Well, in April of this year, if you look at what was happening then, in the United States with deaths. Put in context that on March 1st, COVID-19 was not in the top 100 causes of death in this country. By the April 18th, 19th time period, it was the number one cause of death in this country day after day after day. Nothing has done that to us since swine flu in 1918. Nothing. Now cases, deaths came down in July as they kept coming down, down, down. We kept saying, wait a minute though, deaths are following case numbers by 2 to 3 weeks because that's how long it takes for people to actually get infected, get really sick, and then die, unfortunately. And we said, you know what we're seeing happening here, wait till August comes, case numbers are going to go way back up. Well, in the period of around that April 19th time period, we were seeing about 1,500 deaths a day in this country from this. Well, you know what? Where we're at right now, we're seeing now 1,226 deaths on a seven-day moving average. We're almost back to where we were. We're soon this will be the number one cause of death in the country again. So I just want to point that out, that why when we talk about controlling this virus, this is really unprecedented in public health in the last 100 years.
Couple questions about what you've said. You just said that Minnesota is on track to be one of those southern states, and you gave us the numbers. What did we miss in that moment of opportunity when cases were down in the 300, 375 that we should have been doing? How did we screw up the opportunity, I guess?
Well, you know, I'm not sure, and I take your characterization that we screwed up. I think the challenge has been, and I think the question we just had is a very good question that as a physician, he was asking exactly the right question, is people have a sense that we're over this. There was a sense of invulnerability that occurs in our younger adult population. That has been part of the feeling of this. Bars and restaurants have been a major problem. Indoor air. I can't say that enough times. Indoor air. And so that we saw this explosion there, and people said, well, you know, young adults don't really get that sick. You know, they don't die from it, which isn't true. They do die, not as nearly as frequently as older individuals or people with underlying health problems. But we saw that, and now we're seeing the spillover. You know, I can tell you of far too many examples where Father's Day was a disaster, not at that day because the family all came home, but nobody realized that somebody of the younger adult population was infected and transmitted to family members, and mom or dad are now dead because of that Father's Day event. And so this is the part of the challenge is we're now seeing the deaths rise nationally, both in younger populations to some degree, but also in the older population where it's spilling over. And this is going to just keep playing out around the country over and over and over again. I got to tell you my worst nightmare right now, and I'm going to get a ton of emails. I'm going to get horrible phone calls. I am absolutely just frightened by the prospects this week of Sturgis. Yeah. 275,000 Americans are going to descend on that town, that area. There are going to be a lot of indoor bars. They're going to be an older population relative to young adults, which are going to be put them in at much higher risk. They're going to be there for 9 days, which would just guarantee the transmission that occurs at the beginning will only be amplified through the whole time period. And we're operating as if nothing's new. You know, hey, what the heck? I'm promising you right now, with all the pain I can say, that come mid-August to late August, early September, Sturgis will have one hell of an imprint on this country.
I mean,
and we're not doing anything about it.
And the problem is that it isn't just they all come together and congregate in this town in South Dakota, but then they go back to their own communities, right? And potentially
that's exactly it.
Take the contamination with them.
Do you know what? And you know, I can't say this loudly enough. Right now, over 1,400 healthcare workers in this country have died from COVID-19. Over 1,400. Now, not all of them were healthcare related. Some of them got it in the community, but many were related to their work in the healthcare setting. So just understand, when you get infected, you're expecting people to take care of you. You're expecting if you need hospitalization, someone will be there to hold your hand. It won't be your family members because they won't be able to get in, but someone will be there. The brave doctors and nurses and support staff, respiratory therapists, laboratories, even the janitorial staff in these ICUs, are nothing short of heroes today. So every time you're an infection in this community, just remember, you may be putting somebody else's life at risk too when you have to go be hospitalized, because as much as we try, we're still seeing transmission in our ICUs. I don't think most people think about that.
Dr. Mike Osterholm is with us for the hour from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And we're taking your calls and questions about the way the novel coronavirus is transmitted, what's happening here in Minnesota, Dr. Osterholm's concern that our numbers may soon look like some of those red states, red meaning COVID, high COVID transmission that we've been reading about in the South. We're going to get to vaccines. We'll get to more of your calls and questions. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back. I know we have calls about school reopening. We'll ask Dr. Osterholm about that. I want to ask him about concerns that the development of the vaccines is moving so quickly that a lot of Americans are distrustful of it, and we're not seeing enough data. We'll talk about that. And, of course, what happens if you've already had the virus? When do you become no longer immune again? Can you be a carrier? I know you're curious about that as well. Back to the conversation here with Dr. Michael Osterholm from the University of Minnesota, and to the phones to Annie in St. Paul. Annie, I know it's been a while. I really appreciate the patience.
Good no to problem. Have
you. What do you want to know?
Hi. So Dr. Osterholm, I was wondering if you could give further context or your opinion on the recommendations from the Minnesota Department of Health and Minnesota Department of Education on the 2-week rolling average per 10,000 population. So currently in Ramsey County, it's 16. And I thought I had seen other states that had a lower level of what they were comfortable with for reopening schools.
Well, thank you, Annie, and congratulations. You have your hands full, I can tell that. And you did a really good job of getting them both done, so thank you. Let me just back up and just quickly say that one of the challenges is I think the numbers may be misunderstood a little bit because people were using different types. What the governor had recommended was the number of cases per 10,000 population on a 14-day rolling average, meaning that that really helps greater Minnesota in particular, where, you know, if you have one day where you have four cases, you can be off the chart in terms of your numbers. But if you average them over 14 days, they're very different. So the numbers that you're seeing from Minnesota, basically the 10 per 10,000 per 14-day rolling average would be about what we're seeing in others is about 5 per 100,000 cases, okay? So it's in the same ballpark. It's not a different number. It's just meant to be more helpful to those in smaller population areas. Let me just say real quickly, I commend the governor's office, the Department of Health, and Department of Education. I think they did a remarkable job of threading the rope through the needle. This is a tough area. And I think that by giving school districts the flexibility that they need to have, their expertise is key. Superintendents, parents, teachers, staff all know their districts better than anyone else. And to come down with a top down, you have to do it this way or this way, is not helpful. At the same time, each of these communities are going to be different in terms of what's happening. I mentioned earlier in the show that some of the hottest areas of transmission right now in the state are in greater Minnesota. And so each community, each county has to figure out for themselves, where am I at? Am I prepared to have in-class learning right now, which a number of locations in the state would be, or am I in that hybrid area where for the younger children it's one thing, for those in secondary schools it's going to be a hybrid or distance learning? And so there's the flexibility there. I think the other thing that the governor's office did is they've really committed to supporting the schools and whatever they do in terms of how do we respond from a public health standpoint. What if we have a positive case? What do we do? How do we handle that? And there are teams set up with the local health agencies to help support them through this. Make no mistake, this is going to be a terrible year. It's a COVID year. It's a year we have to understand that, you know, we just have to get through it. And our best job, I think, that we can do for our kids is make safety surely job one for them and the teachers and the staff, but also and realize that mental health, emotional health, having a meal, a hot meal, et cetera, all very critical. But we've just got to do is make sure this is like, in a sense, a bonus year. And I say that trying to find the better of the situation and just say, well, if we have to make up for it next year, we will. There's clear examples of that. In Louisiana, after Katrina, they lost a school year down there, but they made it up in the next year as a bonus year. And so I think that's where we're at right now. And I commend the Minnesota collective effort to try to support school districts, parents, kids in the best way they can.
Two questions here on kids as transmitters. Ross says on Twitter, we have two preschool age children we're planning to send back to daycare this fall. We've heard that young children don't carry spread the virus at worrying levels. Can your guest help answer this? And then to Liz in Mankato, Liz, it sounds like you're also reading about young kids as virus spreaders. What are you interested in?
Well, yeah, so I just even yesterday came across a study that was indicating that for kids who were positive, they actually carried the virus in somewhat higher concentrations in their nasal passages. So I'm feeling confused about the evidence of whether kids do or do not spread the virus less effectively.
Okay.
And, you know, given the high concentration of kids in schools, wanted to get a clarity on what we're learning about kids and transmission.
Dr. Osterholm, what can you draw from the research?
Well, first of all, Liz, let me just confirm for you, if you think you're drinking from a fire hose with information about COVID, welcome to the club. Okay, we all are. And so our job is to try to work through what do we know, not know, what is conflicting, how, et cetera. This is what we know so far about kids. And let me just say, since this, both questioners were about preschool, we've actually been running daycare in Minnesota throughout the entire summer. We never shut it down in March, April. And I can say that while there's been cases in daycare facilities as such, it has not been a challenge, a problem. We've not had one daycare shut down because of it. And to my knowledge, no child has acquired an infection in daycare and become seriously ill. So that's the good news. That's real life experience. That's rubber on the road. In terms of what we know about kids is once you get older, particularly 10 to 12 years of age and older, and this is based on one limited study from Korea, but more data are becoming clearer all the time. If you've been listening about the camp outbreaks, et cetera, that those kids not only can get infected over 10 and older, but they actually can transmit the virus quite well. And we're seeing that right now. This is not just a college age phenomena where socially that facilitates it. The bars, we don't have a lot of 10-year-olds in bars, fortunately. But college age students are surely moving the virus in those places. But we're going to see it in high schools. This is why there's a bifurcation in the recommendations about what to do to handle high school secondary students versus younger students. I think that you can probably today, ironically, given you'd think it's almost the opposite because of the hygiene issue, probably are going to be able to handle younger kids under age 10 in school settings in a more safe manner than we can in those who are older, where if they're not socializing in school, they're sure they're not going to be socializing outside of school. So I'm confident at this point that that the younger kids are not an important part of the transmission picture in our state or, for that matter, anywhere. Which is very different, by the way, than influenza. As we've talked about on this very show before, kids in the influenza season are like little virus reactors. They're very, very infectious, transmit a lot. They bring it home, mom and dad, everybody gets sick. That doesn't appear to be the case here. So given our daycare experience, we're going to hope and just continue to try to maintain that. Know that our challenge is going to be in the junior high and high school students. I think that's where we're going to see transmission.
I have a couple questions about vaccines. We did a show last week and we heard from a number of what I consider to be thoughtful, informed people who are really concerned about the speed with which Operation Warp Speed is proceeding. And it occurred to me in listening to these people call in that there will be Americans who never talk about it openly, but who just quietly decide they're not going to get the vaccine early on. And I wondered what the consequences of that may be.
Well, I think really substantial. And I think this is a very important and very valid issue. I'll just tell you right now, I will do my very best to be your you know, your filter. Okay. Because I'm in the same boat. I'm not going to, you know, I will speak up and speak out if I think that there's anything that is short of the kind of safety work we need to have. And I say that's true for many of my colleagues. We will speak out. At this point, you know, we live in a crazy world. You never know what to expect or what will happen. You know, I would have thought that the hydroxychloroquine issue would have been dead a long time ago. It's not. It keeps coming back. I also am concerned that there is a pressure right now that we're hearing about the Russians will have a vaccine in August and yet this month or early next month, for which there can be no way that they can have the kind of effectiveness or safety data that we would want to have in a vaccine here. The system at the FDA and the European FDA, it's called EMA, are prepared to respond to the, you know, the findings of these studies in a way that at this point we believe will be very thorough, will be absolutely all about the science. But should that ever deviate for any reason, I feel very confident that you'll have hundreds of my colleagues and I standing up saying, no, no, no. And, you know, it's not that we're anticipating a problem. It's not that we think there's going to be a problem. But having the confidence in getting this vaccine carriers, which is exactly what you just noted, is so important. You know, a vaccine is just a vaccine. It doesn't become significant until it becomes a vaccination, which is when it's in your arm. And so we owe the public all the kind of information that we can about safety. There still will be the anti-vaccine crowd who will make proclamations about the lack of safety. We'll try to sway people not to get it. But again, I hope the people will look carefully at the data and then also realize what are the consequences of not getting it. Remember, I just talked about the fact that this, again, is on its way to return to being the number one cause of death in this country. And it won't just be old people, as we have heard so often referred to. It will be lots of people. And I think that's where we have to help them understand what these vaccines can do, what they can't do, and how safe they are.
And then just a specific question about when we hear that, you know, a company like Moderna and some of the others in the UK are in these phase three portions of their trials, which is the human trials, how can you give us a sense of how much time it then takes to analyze that data and then that average Americans might have access to a vaccine? I mean, are we talking about it could all be available by January? Is it going to take longer to crunch the numbers? Do you have some insight on that?
Yeah. One of the unfortunate opportunities here is that the way to test a vaccine is that half of the individuals get the vaccine, half get a placebo or an inert substance of which no one knows who gets which. Meaning that we know from the study design what who gets which, but the individual who got the vaccine or who gave the vaccine doesn't know. We'll follow those people over time. When you have a lot of disease in the community, it's much easier to do these studies. The information accumulates much faster, which is the tragedy of this. We're going to get information pretty quickly. So I think that it's very fair to say that we can have substantial information on protection by this fall. Mid to late fall. It's very possible. Now, the challenge we're going to have is even with 30,000 people included in the study, that's 15,000 who get the placebo, 15,000 who get the vaccine. Mm-hmm. There's lots of subgroups that we need to look at. Those people who have all the risk factors for severe disease, age, gender, underlying heart disease. I can go through the laundry list. BMIs. We know that obesity is a major risk factor right now for severe disease. Once you start looking at those groups, the numbers get more thin because you're distributing cases in the people who got the placebo in all these different categories. And so we'll have to see how good the data are. And what I mean by good, I'm talking about how robust is it. Is there enough data there to say convincingly, boy, this thing really, really made a difference or didn't? The second thing we have to tell people right now in the public is exactly what we know and don't know. And we will not know. We will not know how durable this protection is, meaning we're not going to wait 4 or 5 years to figure out, oh, boy, this antibody, this protection lasts that long, or it doesn't last that long. We're going to use the vaccine beforehand if we have evidence of protection and safety. We may find out after 18 or 20 months, guess what? We got to get a booster every other year or every year. That part we're not going to know. We're going to know about safety relative to the time you get the shot. What happens in the next 24 to 72 hours? Do I get a fever? Do I get a sore arm? I think we're going to see some reactions with this vaccine, with these all these vaccines, that you know people will feel kind of flu-like symptoms possibly for a day or two after they get a shot. Now, if we expect that, we know that's going to happen. We tell people, you know, but it's a better alternative than getting, you know, COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Then the public will, again, I think, be more accepting to know that that's your body's reaction to the vaccine. And then finally, though, we do have to look at the long term. We do have reason to believe that there could be some immune-related conditions that could occur several years after the shots. And the chances are likely very, 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 very low. But we need to continue to follow that, and we will. So that's part of what all these different programs are. Now, the one thing I want to also add, though, that remember we're going to see vaccines from around the world. Don't get confused by that. China's got vaccines. Russia's got vaccines. Europe has got vaccines. India's got vaccines. Brazil's got vaccines, all in the research setting. And what I worry about is we're going to see a lot of confusion about vaccines coming out from some other countries where I wouldn't trust them necessarily as much as I would trust here. And so, again, we will try to do the very best we can to keep you informed which vaccines we're talking about, where they're approved, how they're approved. And I promise you, I promise the listeners on this show that if there is even a hint of somehow we skipped over an important safety or effectiveness step, people like myself will yell from the tallest building in the world that this is wrong.
Okay. Call here from Ellen in Edina. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, no problem. So I have a question. For a person who tests positive with the virus, once they're past contagion and they test negative, if they come in contact, close contact with someone who actively has the virus, is there any way that they can still be a carrier to others?
Okay. First of all, let me just back up and say, when you talk about a carrier, once you've actually been infected and recovered, everything we have right now would suggest that at least for the time being, you're protected against reinfection yourself. Okay. We don't know how long that lasts over time. And if you're getting re-exposed, that may actually just keep boosting your immune system. So that's different than the person who gets infected and doesn't get re-exposed again for 2 years, and then they get exposed. So we're going to be following this very carefully over time to see how long might you be protected. This becomes a huge issue in places like with healthcare workers, et cetera. So I would say right now, if you were really positive for the virus and you've recovered and you're now in contact with someone who's infected, I feel quite confident that you're in good shape, and that the big question is going to be for how long will you be like that? And my hope would be for a long time, but we're going to have to find that out.
How long do you think that research will take?
Until it's done. I mean, I smile because I ask the same question. Okay. And we're not going to know until antibody runs out. So if I'm following people for 6 months and then we see that they don't respond anymore when they're potentially re-exposed, they now get second infections, then we're going to know 6 months. It might be 2 years. It could be longer. So it's going to be an ongoing kind of surveillance, as we call it, to understand people who have been infected or people who have been vaccinated, when will we know if they no longer are protected? And that's going to be a very important thing. And, you know, I hope it's a long, long time, but we have to be prepared for it to last only months as opposed to years.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is with us for the hour, and I've realized that many of you don't have the full hour to listen. We're covering a lot of ground, getting a lot of great information here, and I want to let you know that we'll turn the audio around as quickly as we can, and then you can stream it off the website or you can find it on the podcast. A quick question here from Twitter. Is temperature checking at school, hospitals, et cetera, an effective way to monitor who might be carrying COVID-19?
You know, no one has convincingly demonstrated that temperature monitoring really does make a big difference in reducing the risk of transmission. The most important thing you can do is just tell people, if you're not feeling well, particularly kids and adults, is then that's when you need to be concerned. Don't go to work. Don't go to school. I know for a parent, that's a nightmare because God knows there's a lot of other things that can cause a kid not to feel well besides COVID-19. But that's really the thing to do. And then contact your healthcare provider if you feel like you could have any of the symptoms that would be there. But temperature monitoring of itself has not shown to be effective.
Okay. Call here from Dennis in Orono. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning.
Hi.
Kathy and Dr. Osterholm. Thank you for the program. I really appreciate it. I just want to tell you that I have read Dr. Osterholm's book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. And I think in his humility, Dr. Osterholm never plugs the book. But I really am compelled to ask people to find the book and read it. It is so intuitive, and understanding that it was written in 2017, it's uncanny how remarkable it was in its prognostication on where we are right now. Again, thank you, Dr. Osterholm, for your commitment to public health and the science and doing it in a totally apolitical way. I have a very topical and specific question, but I just want to give a real quick background. I'm a 73-year-old adult, very healthy, choosing to continue to work. And my business involves 120,000 affiliates in 100 countries. So I have a somewhat unique circumstance over the last 25 years of developing relationships with people in Milan, Italy, and Valencia, Spain, in Berlin, and Paris, and London, and Auckland.
Dennis, we're going to run out of time for your question. So would you be able to get to the essence of it? Yeah.
Sure. I've lost 56 friends in a very short period of time. In my recent review of the Mayo Clinic research on plasma and antibody research, there was a reality that there is a very large percentage of asymptomatic people among us, and maybe Dr. Holstrom could speak to that, and the wearing of masks to avoid exposure from people that we don't even know or they don't even know they're sick.
So Dr. Holstrom, asymptomatic spread, if you could.
Yeah, thank you. Clearly, it's a very important part of this virus infection transmission. Literally up to half of the transmission may be from asymptomatic individuals. Also, a second block of people who are asymptomatic or symptomatic, but probably about 20% of infected people are responsible for 80% of the transmission. We actually see some people who are what we call these super spreading individuals. They are in particular indoor air environments. So that we don't have a way to know who those are, but when it happens, they're notable. So, yeah, asymptomatic transmission is really a challenge for us.
I want to ask you about case count. A couple weeks ago, we heard from the CDC that the numbers that we're using day to day to understand how many people have the disease are minimizing the idea of how many people are really dealing with this. Is that right? I think the CDC said something like, look at that number and multiply it by 10. Is that true?
Yeah. We've been saying that from the get-go in terms of trying to come up with what herd immunity is. The last time I was on the show, I think I used the number of between 5 and 7%. Now we think it's closer to 7 to 10% of the population has been infected.
Yeah.
And so if you look at that number, 10% of 325 million people, you can get an idea. Probably at least 32 million people have been infected already, which is far, far below the 4.6 million that have been reported. And so that's exactly right. Some of that is just asymptomatic cases. Some of that is also people that just never got tested. And so they couldn't be called a case. So we've known from the beginning that this is really an underreported disease. And so I typically will say tenfold higher in terms of the total number of people infected.
Dr. Osterholm, thank you so much for the time and the hour. And I can assure you we'll be calling on you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Carrie. Have a good day.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Again, if you missed the show or got in on it late, you can hear all the ground that we covered in our podcast, or you can stream it from my page on the website, nprnews.org.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!